Gal merhaba dear listeners. This is Meltem calling from sunny Maastricht. Welcome to the 15th and final episode of Sesta and Island Talks podcast. What a journey it has been. In this final episode, I am hosting Victoria Harwood Butler-Sloss. I could not have imagined a better final episode since interviewing Victoria has been one of my long-awaited wishes as a podcast producer. Life and its discontents, we could not find a time that fit us both, and now, finally, we are together. In this final episode, we will be elaborating on love, grief, and intergenerational trauma through Victoria's work. Before we begin, Victoria, thank you for making time today all the way from the LA. It is very much appreciated.
Thank you for having me.
Firstly, I would like to ask you a question about your documentary, Cyprus Summer 1974. Mm-hmm. This documentary is the first channel from which I get to know you. In my humble opinion, the documentary is filled with nostalgia and love for an island and lifestyle that is no longer existing. I feel many Cypriots of all ethnicities share this perspective. We are an island of people who constantly long for a past. So tell us a bit more about the documentary, please. How did it come to exist?
Well, the first thing is that I had a diary, which I wrote when I was 13 years old, because I woke up on the morning of the coup and our house was very close to the presidential palace. So I woke up to the sound of gunfire and then my mother running into the room and moving us into the center of the house. And we were obviously looking for my grandfather and my father. They were downtown and the fighting was kind of all around us. I mean, we had bullets in the garden. And eventually my father came home and explained that he had spoken and there was a coup going on. So I had already jumped up and pulled out an old notebook from school and I started writing a diary of what was going on. It was a bit like Twitter. Years later, a friend of mine said, "Vicky, did you know Twitter was going to exist in the future?" And I said, no. I just literally just started writing. And it's a very just a factual thing. So when it was 40 years later, I decided to do something with the diary. So I had it printed on canvas and framed, and I exhibited it in a little shop, which I dressed with all of the things from my grandfather's shop so that it would sort of resemble a shop that you had flown from. And it was right on the border. So in the evening, when people would come, I would open it in the evening, and I had it almost like an installation. So it was following the days of the coup. Had it on for 10 days from July the 14th. So you could come and read what was happening in real time at 40 years prior. And, you know, I took a lot of footage of that and everything. And then a friend of mine, Nora Armani, she runs the film festival up in New York, socially relevant film festival, said, "Why don't you make a little documentary about it?" So I contacted a friend of mine and I said, "Can we throw a bit together about this and make a little tiny movie?" And then she really got into it and it ended up making a film. And we submitted it and then we put it on YouTube. And I don't know how many people have watched it, but it's, you know, like 40,000 or something, which was a surprise to me. Yeah.
Well, I was one of those people, and your documentary has certainly inspired me. I mean, it inspired me to write my master thesis on Cyprus.
That's amazing. I'm very flattered. I mean, that's amazing.
Well, you never know whom you inspire.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But I, when you were talking about something, you know, making a diary at the age of 13, I'm, you know, I watched this documentary multiple times and I'm hearing it right now from the perspective of a 33-year-old person who also started writing. And I think if I may dare to say, maybe writing a diary was your way of processing things at that time.
I think so. I always loved history, and I think a small little part of me always thought this is a historic thing. I'm sitting here in the middle of a war, you know, so I have to write it down. A friend of mine who saw the film later said, I always wonder about a person that kept a ticket from the Lydra Palace swimming pool for like 40 years. I said, well, yeah, it was in my pocket when I was evacuated eventually. And so I kept it. But, you know, so even as a 13-year-old, I was thinking of archiving stuff. So I used to keep all my letters, and I found them in a box one time. And I literally had everyone, you know, in chronological order and alphabetically. So, you know, I think you can call it OCD or something, but it's always fascinated me, history and letters and stamps and packaging, you know, things that tell stories. Everything to me tells a story. All mm-hmm. inanimate things tell stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I really like this personalized storytelling a lot in the documentary. That is the part that spoke me the most. And that actually, in a sense, brings me to my second question, because you made a documentary, but you're also an author, right? So your book, The Seamstress of Urfa, is inspired by your family history. It is fiction, though, but it is a book that contains elements of love, different sorts of love, so family love, romantic love, country love, but also elements of displacement and identity. One of the things that research tells us is that, you know, writing or being creative in general is a great way of tackling intergenerational trauma, and intergenerational trauma is as inherited as our genes. And I think we, as Cypriots of all ethnicities, we are carrying this intergenerational trauma of wars, not only one war, of wars in our everyday life, regardless of where we are. And my question to you with regard to the book is the following. Was this book a way of making peace with yourself and with your intergenerational trauma, a way of tackling it, or a way of remembering your family history?
I think it was more intrinsic than that, in that you talk about intergenerational trauma. I think in every Armenian family, we come out of the womb being told about the genocide, maybe not directly, but a grandmother, a great grandmother, an aunt who disappeared, somebody that nobody talks about. Sometimes it's shadowy and sometimes it's there. And I grew up in an extended family with my grandparents and great grandparents who were there. And so I grew up with these stories, but it wasn't until I was in my 20s and I was in drama school, and we were given a task that summer to write down everything, just write everything. So, you know, I would sit in the afternoons with my grandmother and she would tell me all the stories about her life. And so I eventually started writing them down. She would tell me in Armenian and then I would translate it. So I had all of these stories, which are the basis of the book, for a long, long time. But then, of course, I started researching them with other members of the family, and I noticed that everyone gives a slightly different version of the story. And that's because we are all the hero of our story. So we center the story around ourselves. And I liked that aspect of it as well, so that I would start telling stories from each person's point of view. And sometimes the versions might not quite marry together.
Yeah, I found that very beautiful about the book. For me, I really took my time to read the book. Sometimes it was difficult to bring different pieces together. But what you're saying is also really interesting, because, you know, we are always the center of the stories that we tell. And well, for me also, growing up in Cyprus, I always heard stories about the war and division and our relationship with the Greek Cypriots. And every story is you would expect it to be general, but it's not factual. It's very personalized. Yeah. So that is also something that I can connect with you. Of course, the magnitude of a genocide can never be, you cannot compare it. That's not the idea. But the storytelling aspect in the book and in the documentary, I think it's very powerful. It's very personal. That is personally for me what makes your interesting very interesting, because these are not history books. Obviously, you're interested in history, but these are also very much personalized stories in which people who have experienced displacement, intergenerational trauma, grieving, they can in a certain way connect with you, right?
Yeah. Funnily, you say that, because I'm just coming to the end of the second book in the series, because The Seamstress was the first one. And I noticed that the two main characters have started sort of becoming the two sides of my brain. Like, one is very philosophical and peace-loving and everything, and the other one just says it how it is. So I became aware of that as I was coming to the end of the writing. I was like, this is just me and my, you know, the voice on my back, you know, the two of us arguing together. One is always pacifist and the other one's always like, you know, aggressive.
Mm. We will talk about your future work in one of the upcoming questions. I actually look forward to that. But before that, there is something that I also would like to ask you. So one of the most remarkable things that I constantly come across in your works is the intrinsic relationship between love and grieving. I mean, I say this as an author, there is a lot of love in your work. I mean, for me, for instance, one of the things that I always remember with you is the scene in the documentary when your friend dies, and then they found this photo album of Cyprus in his car.
Yeah.
You know, this is always, I'm like, and you ask in the documentary, why? And then I'm also like, why? And there is just so much love between people, but to also places. And in this case, of course, Cyprus, I'm taking it. But there is also loss. There is also some sort of grieving. And this relationship was something that was, for me personally, the intrinsic relationship between love and grieving in general, it was too abstract for me to understand as a person until some life events happened in my life and I lost dear ones. I'm a Cypriot who is Dutch-based, who is based in the Netherlands, and I do speak Dutch language. And when Dutch speak about grieving, to begin with, it's very different from how the Levant people talk about grieving. But they have this saying that I really, really like. They say in Dutch, een plek geven, which could be literally translated as to give it a place. Mm-hmm. So you give grief a place, you give pain a place. And, I know, for instance, that you lost your beloved husband, William, not long ago.
Yeah.
And the grief that you had to process is also inspired your future work, which we are going to talk about. But before we deal with that, I have a question for you, maybe not necessarily as a podcaster, but maybe as a woman. How do you give grief a place when you desperately long for someone?
That's a very interesting question. And this might be a very weird answer, because as you say, the two of them are interconnected, grief and love. And the depth of your love will equal the depth of your grief. And if you can sort of remember that and work backwards, you will also know that in the depth of your grief, that is actually love that you're feeling. It's hard. But there is a little sort of switch, like a little button. And sometimes you have to sort of access that button. And the memories of somebody that you really love come up, and this overwhelming wave of grief will hit you. And if you can find that button and switch it backwards, you're suddenly filled with love. I mean, I've literally sat in my house and felt just as loved as when he was here. And also, when you are losing somebody that you really love, it is at the same time the most horrendous thing that will ever happen to you, and the most beautiful, because first of all, the time that you spend together is very precious. And really, when somebody that you really love passes away in your hands, it's a very beautiful moment. If you can imagine that you really love somebody and they are there to take you out of this world, how wonderful is that? It was really a very beautiful moment, and at the same time, one of the most horrendous things that ever happened to me. But if you can remember the beauty, that helps through the grief. And of course, just knowing that you have to trust in time, because time is your ally on earth. Time really does help. And you can just say, today, I'll get through today. I'll get through tomorrow. And for me, my book was getting published at the same time. And in fact, I had to delay. And it was good, because then I was very busy for a year after that, running around with the book and promoting it. And I can say even that year that was filled with horrible pain for me was also filled with, when I look back at it, such beauty, because so many people supported me just silently, you know, family and friends. Yeah, I mean, they say there's only one way to deal with grief, and that is to go through it and celebrate it. Free fall, go for it. And, you know, it lessens over time. But here I am, you know, it's going to be 7 years, actually, which is a shock to me. And, you know, as you can see, I get emotional even now.
And I want to thank you for being so open, because this is when one of the things which I really hated about grieving, if I may say it.
No.
People don't talk about the, you know, people always conceal this fact that you will grieve for someone that you love. You know, we always go through this happily ever after as if death or lost.
Yeah.
It's not part of love, but it is part of love, and we don't talk about it. And grief changes you, but if I may say this, just listening to you and really trying to process also my emotions at the same time, I think it changes you, but it's for me as an outsider to hear that you find a way to cope with grief through love, by love.
Yeah,
I think it is very powerful of a statement. I don't know if that helps you, but it resonates with me.
Good, good. I mean, the other thing is that there are no answers, and everyone will grieve the way they grieve. And there isn't a playbook. There isn't a, you know, these are the things to do and not to do. The only thing I can suggest is, some people ask me afterwards what not to do. And the thing is, don't ask questions. Even when you say, how are you? Sometimes it just hits your brain. You're like, how am I? How am I? I don't know how I am. It becomes very confusing. So just don't ask questions. Make a cup of tea, take some food, go for a walk, you know, call your friend and say hi. But the questions always flummoxed me.
Yeah, I can imagine that. But
I wanted to make a t-shirt at one point saying, no, I'm not sleeping. Yes, the kids are eating. We're okay. And wear it on a t-shirt because people were always saying, are you sleeping? Are the kids eating? How are you? You know? Anyway, yes.
Yeah. I think these are the worst type of questions that you can get. Even in a simple situation, and
people don't know what to say. So you also can't be offended by the questions. Just, you know, answer them. But at the same time, it's like it does. All questions confuse the mind at a time like that, I have to say.
Yeah, of course, because you find it difficult to carry your own body, I think.
Yeah.
Right? So you just try to exist. I get that. Yeah. But one of the strongest things that I also hear with you is that, I mean, this process maybe unintentionally also made you creative. I mean, you were also creative maybe before, but maybe in a certain way it added to your writing.
Well, I do delve deep when I write, but actually it stymied me. Because I found that after the first year of traveling around with the book and promoting it, I suddenly hit a brick wall and I couldn't write and could barely pick up a book and read it. So I could watch TV, and I used to be such an avid reader. I would read a book all the time. I was always with a book in my hand, and I just couldn't pick up a book. And you know, that lasted a year or two, and, you know, slowly I'm back into reading. And then I got back into writing, and I'm finishing my second book. So it did work eventually, but again, time. And, you know, it took way longer than I thought. But there was, you know, but yes, I think so. It's a double-edged sword, because like I say, it stymied me, but at the same time, I think I cut to the chase more when I write now. I'm just like, just go straight for the jugular.
Yeah. Which is what I wanted to ask you, because if I'm not mistaken, last time we were exchanging some WhatsApp messages, I told you that I wanted to make this program and about the relationship between love and grieving. And you told me that your book was also about this. Please correct me if I'm wrong. Your next book?
The second book is called Love in Aleppo. And it's all about the family actually going to Aleppo and rebuilding their lives. So it starts in 1922. And I think it finishes in 1954. I keep fiddling with the end as to where it's actually going to end. And it follows my grandmother this time, although all of the characters from the first book are still in the second book. And it follows her, and it's mostly about her love affair with my grandfather. But, you know, without being much of a spoiler alert, he was a big womanizer. So it also involved a lot of heartbreak. And so once I'd come up with the title Love in Aleppo, which is the working title, but I think I'm going to stick with it, I decided that I actually had to develop more of the story about love. So I really delved into love for the city, love for your nation, love that has gone wrong, love for children, love in every form, love with your mistress. So it really is a book about love. But like you say, the scorpion's tail is that there's always some disaster involved in it, even if you still are with the person that you absolutely love and they love you back, but they just can't keep their hands off other women.
Yeah.
Religious love as well. I mean, there's a lot. And I do delve a lot into, you know, Cyprus, because the book starts in Aleppo and then it moves to Cyprus. So the whole second half of the book is in Cyprus. And it was amazing because I was just there recently and I was walking the streets as I'm writing about them all around, you know, the old city of Nicosia and around Alabahmet and also Uzunian Street and Leda Street and all of the little areas through there. Of course, there was the period I'm writing about, there was no border. So I had to do a lot of scoping out on the border, you know, on both sides, thinking, oh, if they walk down here, they could cut across that field, which is now impossible, and go that way. So, yeah, it was interesting.
Well, to be honest, I look forward to reading it. Do you know when it would be published? Of course, this is such destructive question for the artistic process.
No, basically, I'm going to have to submit it now. Once I finished it, I'm putting the final touches on it and I'm sending it to a friend of mine to read. And then I'm going to be submitting it. So that's the next process.
Great. Well, I certainly look forward to reading it. For the listeners, the link of the seamstress of Urfa and the link of the documentary Cyprus Summer 1974, they will be provided on the description of this final episode, if you would like to buy the book or if you would like to watch the documentary. Thank you, Victoria. So love in Aleppo. Well, we all, I think, look forward to reading it when it gets published. Is there a way we can follow your work?
Well, actually, I have a website, which is planetvix.com, planetvix.com.
Okay.
And on there, all of my work is on there. So you can follow the, I just opened up a page for Love in Aleppo, but everything else is there, including the documentary, all of the background work, and, you know, some stuff about me.
Oh, perfect. Then I'm just going to share that link directly instead of sharing everything separately.
Yes. Yeah.
Perfect. Yes. Well, thank you very much, Victoria. Thank you very much for making time today. I really, really appreciate it. Of course, I would talk about only one of your work for hours, but it is important to keep podcasts short, to the point, because, it's audio material we have right now in this world, short attention spans. But I truly enjoyed talking with you, and I look forward to reading your upcoming book. I'm experiencing, if I also may say this, normally I like to give my hosts all the attention and act like a shadow person. But because this is the final episode of Sesta, I would like to say a couple of words as well. Well, this is for me a very emotional moment because this podcast played a very important role in my personal and professional development. Thanks to this podcast, I took part in 6 UN projects and 1 Womenica project in USA. And most importantly, this podcast made me meet amazing people who inspired me greatly at incredibly dark times. So thank you very much to everyone who took part in it. I would like to finish this podcast with 2 notes. One would be a note from you to your beloved husband, William. And the other one would be a love note that I have written to myself because of all the grief, loss, intergenerational trauma that I experience. I finally, at the age of, in my 30s, I decided to work on myself. And while working on myself, I understood that the most important love you can have is the love that you have for yourself. And the most important relationship you have is the one that you have with yourself. So I'm working on that. And I would like to read a note, a love note that I have for the first time written to myself. So I would like to give you the floor and then we can finalize.
Oh, you want me to read first?
Yes, please, if you don't mind.
No, I don't mind. Let me just get to the page. So this actually was something that I wrote to my husband when I met him. This is actually pulled from my diary. And at some point, I decided I was going to dedicate my first book to him because he really supported me financially, emotionally, as a father, as a parent to our children. He was there. And it allowed me to write the book. So I dedicated the book to him because the book is also about all of the other people who I would dedicate it to. So they're in there. So I wrote the dedication. And then, of course, he died. So it became more poignant. And I remember the publishers calling me saying, "Do you want to change the dedication?" And I said, "No, it's now a dedication. It has a different meaning now. The only thing we changed is we added, the date of his death at the end of it. But here it is. I'm 34 and I meet a man with very blue eyes who looks inside me. He tells me he can see me at 16, at 8, as a child when he makes love to me. His eyes open and close very slowly next to my face. Sometimes they half close and look down, and they are grey-green, cool, and then they slide up and pierce me with open sky. Sometimes he lies close and breathes into my mouth, and the breath is sweet, whatever we've done. I clutch momentarily at the edges of this deep drop into his love, then free fall, my chest open to the heart, and drift in on his sweet air. For William, with love."
Love this part of the book. I already told you this before the podcast, and hearing it from you was a magical experience for me, Victoria. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm 33. If I meet someone next year, then I'm going to let you know.
Oh, please. maybe that I can dedicate to you so that you can meet a very beautiful man.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Well. Yeah. Okay.
It happens. Well, it happens. Do you know how it happened? my mother came to me for Christmas and she gave me a gift. It was a beautiful gold cross and it was gold and silver gold, white gold. And she said, "Wear it and it'll bring you luck in love and in career," whatever. So I was wearing it the night I met him. But I had also made a New Year's resolution to say yes to everything. So every time somebody said, "Let's go to the movies," yes. "Shall I come and see you?" Yes. "Do you want to do this?" Yes. So I was invited to the premiere of a play and I said yes. And a friend of mine said, "Do you want to go? And I'll come with you." Yes. And then I went in there and I met William and he said, "Hello, my name's William. Would you like a drink?" And I said, "Yes." And then suddenly, we were married.
Wow. Well, yeah. I'm saying yes to everything,
you
Victoria.
Say yes. You say yes.
Well, okay, because this podcast got personal, I also want to say this. Eventually, this is my own podcast. I mean, it's not listened by millions of people. I think we can be very personal here. When I was reading this, there was a man with incredibly beautiful blue eyes. He hurt me a lot. And I've been trying to process the hurt since July 2023. I don't know if it will ever be over. But in this time of processing, like I said, I'm cultivating some personal love. And eventually, this shouldn't be about him. It should be about me.
Yeah.
So this is what I have written for me. "Dear Malcolm, dear me, dear woman, dear daughter, dear sister, dear teacher, be happy of how far you have come, for your heart has been broken for so many times. Be happy of how genuine you have stayed, for mediocrity has become the norm. Embrace your soft heart, cuddle your warm soul. Smile and grieve for the person that you have been and you will never be. Smile and cherish the radiant woman that you are and you're becoming every day. Let waves of blue grief turn you into your real self. Don't be afraid. Accept what will never become and what has been with tears in your eyes. Blossom for the sunny futures ahead of you, for your shine will inspire others in their own unique life journey. And you have inspired me, Victoria. So thank you for that.
Well, I think you're shining bright. That was lovely. That's good.
Oh, I'm going to end this podcast and end it all. Dear listeners, this was Sesta, an Island Talks podcast. Thank you for tuning in for the last 3 years. You can listen to all episodes of Sesta on Spotify or on any other podcast platform that you use. This was it from me. Goodbye for now. Stay healthy, stay with peace, stay tuned.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus, Island Talks, open, diverse, free.